Abu Ghiba by Sheikh Tusi. So it is weird that having all these proofs, I mean the intellectual proofs, and if someone is not going to accept the intellectual ones, all these narrations, this Wahhabi scholar is not referring to all these proofs and especially all these narrations, and also only mention three narrations which talk about the ta'wil or deeper layers of meaning of the verses of the Noble Book of Quran. Now, the last point, which is about these ta'wili narrations, these narrations which talk about a deeper layer of meaning of these narrations.
Yeah.
First of all, let's compare the narrations which talk about the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the narrations which I call it ta'wili narrations. I mean the narrations which interpret some verses of the Quran to refer to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. I just mentioned Al-Kafi by Sheikh Kulaini. In the first volume of Al-Kafi, Sheikh Kulaini has quoted 36 narrations which explicitly talk about the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Out of these 36 narrations, only three of them are so-called ta'wili narrations, which means that the remaining narrations, the 33 narrations, they are not related to ta'wilat of the Quran. Rather, they are quoting from the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, proving the birth and the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So my point is that when you compare the narrations proving the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to the narrations which refer to the verses of the Quran, they are much more. I mean, the narrations, the mutawatir narrations that we have about the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one.
Even if we reject the ta'wili narrations, which of course we are not going to do that, even if we reject them, we have so many other narrations to prove the ghiba, the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
But Sheikh, what you refer to is are the series of hadith or narrations which are available in Shia sources. And the person who poses the doubt actually thinks in a Sunni worldview. How can we actually close these two different viewpoints to each other?
That's a very good point. You know, the question, the doubt that is raised by this Wahhabi scholar is that he is talking about the Shia. In his book, he claims that whatever I mention in this book is based on Shia books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quoting from Sunni sources. So he claimed that the Shia, to prove the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they have only these ta'wili riwayat.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned three narrations. We want to prove him wrong that, I mean, from Shia perspective, first of all, we have rational arguments.
Actually, he yu'man bi-ba'd wa yakfur bi-ba'd.
Exactly.
He chooses some and he ignores the others.
Exactly. And he ignores the greater part. This is the problem. We are telling that, first of all, we have rational arguments. When it comes to the narrations, even if you ignore these ta'wili narrations, we have so many other narrations to prove the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, to the extent that we are not in need of those ta'wili narrations.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that we do not believe in them? Of course, we believe in those ta'wili narrations as well. And I mean, it needs a separate discussion. Our point is that the claim of this Wahhabi scholar that Shia only have these ta'wili narrations to prove the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is absolutely wrong.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. The next misconception, which is again posed by this person, is on the longevity of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This person wants to say that, rationally speaking or intellectually speaking, this cannot be accepted. But before we ask you, Sheikh, to shed some light on that, I want to answer this doubt in an amateur way, not in a professional way that you usually do, scientifically. I can invite this respected brother to recite some verses of the Holy Quran. Prophet Nuh alayhi salam, lived for almost 1,000 years, minus 50 years. So this single sample can be enough to nullify the argument of this questioner. So what is the good answer, Sheikhna, to this doubt which is posed by this person on the longevity of Imam of the Age?
Yeah, we know that the issue of the age of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is one of the frequently asked questions about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This Wahhabi scholar in his book, interestingly, he refers to the example that you mentioned, to the age of Prophet Nuh alayhi salam. He also refers to Jesus and Khidr and Idris. But he tries to say that there is a big difference between Mahdi as viewed by the Shia and these people that inshallah I will explain. I think today we have only time to mention the doubt because, again, to be faithful to this Wahhabi scholar, we need to mention the doubt completely. He says that it is very unlikely for a person to live for more than 1,100 years. And mainly, I mean, this Wahhabi scholar is referring to the verses and narrations. He says that in the age of Islam, we cannot find any person to have lived for more than 120 years.
Yeah.
He says that there is a sahih and authentic narration from the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family that in the last days of his life, he says that tonight, those people who are alive on the earth, none of them will be alive after 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he says that those people who at that night, they were only, for example, 1 year, they did not live for more than 100 years. Inshallah, we'll analyze this narration. Then he continues and says that when this is the case at the time of the Prophet, for sure the same is the case for the following generations. And according to another authentic narration, the age of the nation of the Prophet is between 60 and 70, and only few people will live after 70 years. Again, we will analyze this narration as well.
Yeah, true.
So he says that that is why the Shia scholars, they have made a comparison between Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and some of the prophets, like Prophet Nuh alayhi salam, who invited the people for 950 years. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, they say that Mahdi is like Jesus or Khidr or Ilyas, who are alive. And this Wahhabi scholar claimed that some Shia have made a comparison between Mahdi and Iblis, the Satan, who is still alive. So all these are claims by this Wahhabi scholar, and he continues to say that there is a big difference between Mahdi and Nuh and Jesus and the other prophets, but I think we need to postpone it to the following session.
Definitely. We shall focus on this aspect of this answer, inshallah, in our next session. It's beautiful that this person wants to actually distinguish between the longevity of Prophet Nuh and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, based on what he calls it a document, or I don't know, based on what he called it an argument. But it shall be answered, inshallah, in details in our next session. Many thanks, Sheikh, for your explanations and answers to the question, and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time. وقائدا ونصرا
Round the World with Reporters.
In London, thousands hit the streets, furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Sudam, London.
The legacy of the past in the north of Ireland still haunts the present, particularly as the victims of the violence are still searching for the truth. For the family of those killed in the Ballymurphy massacre in 1971, their fight, first and foremost, was to set the record straight, and after 50 long years, their wait was finally over. As a coroner inquest ruled that 10 civilians, including a mother of 8 and a Catholic priest, killed across 3 days, were entirely innocent. The inquest found that at least 9 of the 10 killed were shot by the British Army, and that the force used was disproportionate, considering the paratroopers were firing from protected positions from a long distance away.
The coroner's court heard almost 100 days of evidence from more than 150 witnesses to conclude what the families of the deceased have known for 50 years, that their loved ones were entirely innocent and should not have been shot dead that day. But why have they had to wait so long for this verdict?
While the families have been vindicated, the fight to bring the perpetrators to justice is still not over, according to Patrick O'Murray, a human rights lawyer who represents them.
Prosecutions have been very rare in this jurisdiction, arising from the conflict when those who perpetrated the events are state actors. Many families would argue that we have had a de facto amnesty for British soldiers and police officers, where they haven't been subject to the normal rules of the criminal justice system or the rigours of the law.
The families feel their loved ones were killed twice, first by the British soldiers, and then their characters assassinated by the British state. Inside and outside the court, the families cheered the fact that after a long and hard-fought battle, the truth had been acknowledged, and the names of their loved ones exonerated. But their cheers were bittersweet, because not everyone lived long enough to see this day. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the Arms Trade Treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iya, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country, which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Saeed Mohammad, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. So I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zareh Foumani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as Major General. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan. They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. Iran has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against the deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of Iran's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirza Beghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hard-working efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare.
The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujiri, Tehran.
Thank you.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel for Israel, for a Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv. The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless and I can't believe this till this moment.
The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hundreds of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds. This was the latest in a series of confrontations in the Holy City. Palestinian worshippers gathered at the mosque's courtyard after performing morning prayers to prevent a planned raid by Israeli settlers later Monday as part of their activities to mark what they call Jerusalem Day. It's the day when East Jerusalem Al-Quds was occupied in 1967 and later annexed by Israel. Israeli forces forces raided the courtyards, firing tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets against Palestinians to force them out of the holy site. However, the Palestinians remained steadfast.
What is going on in Al-Quds is a massacre, a comprehensive war to evacuate the city from its real residents. Palestinians across the world don't remain silent. People in Al-Quds are clashing with the occupation forces to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They will never allow the settlers to desecrate their holy site.
After the clashes, Israeli forces decided to change the path of the Jerusalem Day flag march, so the settlers had to march through the old town's streets. The latest confrontations follow days of clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the Jerusalem Al-Quds. The clashes escalated with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, after Israel tightened its grip on the city and prevented the Palestinians to freely perform their religious duties. Palestinians demand immediate action from Arab states. They say the only appropriate response to the crimes is immediate halt of any ties with the Zionist entity.
First of all, the Palestinian leadership must cancel any agreement with the Israeli regime. Then, he should call on the Arab states to stop any effort to normalize ties with Israel. We want urgent measures by the international community to stop the bloodshed in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The tension has also been fueled by an eviction plan in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds, where Israeli settlers have waged a lengthy battle to take over Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israel's Supreme Court was to hold a hearing on the eviction on Monday, but the session was postponed due to the unrest in Al-Quds. Israeli violence has sparked international condemnations. Meanwhile, the UN chief has urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Amid soaring tensions in Jerusalem Al-Quds, which has seen weeks of clashes, the Israeli authorities question whether a new uprising can now be inevitable. Unabating protests across the occupied territories have proved that Jerusalem Al-Quds is a red line for Palestinians, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A comparison of the number of doses of vaccines manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. We now present you a two-part article written by Prabir Purkayasla, the founding editor of Newsclick.in, a digital media platform. The piece is titled, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. More than an eighth of the world's population living in rich countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union have access to more than 50% of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses. According to Our World in Data, about 112 million people in the United States alone received at least a single inoculation by 8th of April. This is more than 12 times the total number of people vaccinated in the entire continent of Africa, which has four times the population of the United States. On 8th of April, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that nearly 13 million of the 31.6 million doses delivered so far to 45 African countries have been administered. And if we do not count the vaccine doses that have been administered in Morocco, truly an outlier in Africa, as of 8th of April, the United States has received almost 35 times the vaccine doses that Africa has. No wonder Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, called the distribution of vaccines grotesque and a catastrophic moral failure. Let us not call reserving the bulk of vaccines for a handful of rich ex-colonial or settler colonial states vaccine nationalism. Let us call it what it is, vaccine apartheid at a global level. How much of the COVID-19 vaccine manufactured in the rich countries has gone to the rest of the world? The answer is that the rich countries have kept their supplies almost entirely to themselves. Moderna's vaccine production has mostly been used to inoculate the population in the United States, besides supplying it to some countries in Europe and also to Canada. Pfizer has supplied its vaccines to the United States from its US facilities, and to Europe and to the United Kingdom from its European plants. It has also supplied vaccines to the occupied Palestine and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and begrudgingly parts of Latin America, but that makes up a small fraction of its total production. The rich countries have had some squabbles with one another over vaccine supplies. An example of this is the clash between the European Union and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca and the United Kingdom. Perhaps this is why they have had no time to think about the rest of the world. A comparison of the number of doses manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. Where has the rest of the world gotten its vaccines from? It appears that the only other sources of vaccine for low- and middle-income countries are those being produced by China and India, with Russia providing smaller amounts of vaccines. This is substantiated by various press sources that recount how countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia are receiving supplies from China, India, or Russia. How much of the vaccine supplies from Sinovac, a Beijing-based biopharmaceutical company, and Sinopharm, a Chinese state-owned company, was administered locally in China, and how much has been provided to the rest of the world? According to a 5th of April article in Nikkei Asia, which relied on data provided by Air Infinity, an analytics company, about 115 million doses of the vaccine have been used in China, and the same amount has gone to the rest of the world. Similarly, based on the figures released by India's Ministry of External Affairs website on 15th of April, more than 65 million doses of the vaccine produced by the Serum Institute's Covishield vaccine licensed from AstraZeneca have been exported to other countries. With the surge in the rate of infection in India recently, the doses exported from that country have fallen in comparison with the number of vaccine doses it has administered to its own population. According to a 13th of April article in Deutsche Welle, more than 104.5 million people in India have received at least one dose of the inoculation, whilst India has shipped more than 60 million doses of the vaccine to 76 nations. China, India and Russia are the only three major countries that have been willing to export vaccines whilst also vaccinating their own populations. To curtail the sharp rise of COVID-19 cases in India, the country is currently prioritizing its supplies and has temporarily halted exports of vaccines from India. This has slowed down vaccine supplies to other countries significantly, particularly in March and April, and will impact the COVAX program, particularly in Africa, which is heavily dependent on the World Health Organization's Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT Accelerator Program, and its vaccine pillar of COVAX. The Sputnik V, developed by the highly respected Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology, has shown its efficacy in clinical trials. However, ramping up its production has been slow. Russia's production capacity of vaccines is not on the same scale as Indian and Chinese manufacturers. While many Indian and South Korean companies have expressed interest in manufacturing the Sputnik V, they have yet to start doing so. Only one South Korean company, Hankook Chorus Farm, has started production of Sputnik V, and a large consortium of South Korean companies has signed up to manufacture 500 million doses. Five Indian companies, Hetero Biopharma, Gland Pharma, Stelis Biopharma, Virchow Biotech, and Panacea Biotech, have inked deals with the Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, for setting up a combined production capacity of 850 million doses. Meanwhile, even as India looks to ramp up its current vaccine production to meet the worldwide demand, it has not been able to do so. The Serum Institute of India, the largest vaccine manufacturer in the world, can produce up to 100 million Covishield doses per month and can add to that capacity with additional investments. Similarly, Biological E, which is expected to produce 600 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine after recent approvals by the US Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has not been able to begin production. This raises questions about what is preventing these companies from expanding and producing vaccines. This is where the global media, read the dominant Western media, fail to inform people about the bottlenecks against ramping up production around the world. Apart from the intellectual property rights issue, the major roadblock to quickly ramping up global vaccine production is that the rich countries such as the United States, the European Union, and Britain have been refusing to export not only vaccines but also supplies of intermediate products and raw materials required for vaccine production in other countries. The United States is using a 1950 Korean War vintage Defense Production Act to curb export of vaccines as well as raw materials and other inputs vital for vaccine production elsewhere. According to an article in Mint Press, in a letter to Indian Commerce Secretary Anup Wadhawan and Foreign Secretary Harsh Vardhan Singla, Prakash Kumar Singh of the Serum Institute wrote that by invoking the Defense Production Act, the United States is making it difficult to import necessary products like cell culture medias, raw material, single-use tubing assemblies and some specialty chemicals to India. The US restrictions, which prioritize Moderna's and Pfizer's vaccine production, harm not only the Serum Institute's Covishield production, but also its efforts to produce another 1 billion doses of Novavax vaccine. According to an article published in the Financial Times, Adar Poonawalla, the chief executive of the Serum Institute of India, told a World Bank panel recently, he said, "The Novavax vaccine, which we're a major manufacturer for, needs these raw materials and items from the United States. We're talking about having free global access to vaccines, but if we can't get the raw materials out of the United States, that's going to be a serious limiting factor." Similarly, Mahima Dattla, managing director of Biological E, which is committed to making Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine in India, voiced concern about the US embargo on vital intermediate products and supplies. In an interview with the Financial Times, she said materials that are a vital part of vaccine production are made only by a limited number of companies that are under the US embargo. Unless the global supply chain is viewed in its entirety and not with the me-first approach of the United States and the other rich countries, it will not be possible to control the coronavirus pandemic. The Indian government, which looked quite willing to be the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue's COVID-19 vaccine supplier, as also seen from the joint statement by Quad leaders, the spirit of the Quad seems to have backed off from any public engagement with the US government on this count. There has been no public response by New Delhi relating to the plea of the big Indian generic manufacturers on how to facilitate both capital and the much-needed supplies for rapidly increasing production. Instead, the Indian government has slowed down its export of vaccines to other countries, worsening the global crisis. The other part of the ugly picture of vaccine apartheid is the vicious campaign mounted against the Chinese and Russian vaccines. It is bad enough that the United States and its allies are not willing to share the vaccine they produce with the rest of the world. Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are not available to most low- and middle-income countries, and even if they were available, these countries would not be able to provide the ultra-cold chain infrastructure required by these mRNA vaccines. An anti-China and anti-Russia campaign by Western media means that they are willing to deny the global population of any vaccine, even if this means taking on the risk of new variants of the virus emerging and the permanent threat of COVID-19 looming large across the world. The latest in this anti-China campaign is twisting the statement of Gao Fu, the head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Gao Fu suggested improving the efficacy of the vaccines being produced by China by mixing them. This is being touted as a rare admission of weakness and proof of the poor quality of the Chinese vaccines. How are similar statements by AstraZeneca of using Sputnik V as a second dose along with a first dose of AstraZeneca not viewed in the same light? The figures to show more than 90% efficacy for Moderna and Pfizer and about 62% for Oxford AstraZeneca, compared with supposedly only about 50% efficacy for the Sinovac vaccine, do not reflect a true comparison. In clinical trials in Turkey and Indonesia, the figures for Sinovac's vaccine were 83.5% and 65.3% respectively. The low figure of 50.4% in the Brazilian trial was a result of counting very mild symptoms as positive cases, which other vaccine trials did not count. According to an article in Bloomberg, data from Brazil's Sinovac Coronavac trials showed that it provided 78% protection in mild cases and 100% protection in moderate and severe cases. Esper Callas of the School of Medicine, University of Sao Paulo in Brazil, pointed out in an article in Science magazine, if you can prevent someone being seen by a doctor by 78% and prevent hospital admissions by 100%, let's give a toast and celebrate. The good news is that Sinovac's vaccine is maintaining its efficacy against the more transmissible and dangerous Brazilian P1 variant at more than 50%. AstraZeneca's vaccine has low efficacy of just 10.4% against the B1351 prevalent currently in South Africa, although it was more effective against the B117 variant, otherwise known as the UK variant. I have earlier reported about the World Trade Organization WTO rules and the rich countries' unwillingness to suspend IPR rules temporarily so that all the vaccine producers can re-engineer their facilities very quickly to produce COVID-19 vaccines. In the books of the rich countries, the tens of billions of dollars to be earned as profits in the vaccine market by Big Pharma far outweigh the benefits of saving millions of lives. This also explains the vicious campaign against Chinese and Russian vaccines. For Big Pharma and for the rich countries, it is profit over lives every time. Whether it was during the AIDS epidemic earlier or with the COVID-19 pandemic now. Vaccine apartheid and support for Big Pharma are driving the policies of the rich countries. It does not matter that these policies will perpetuate the continuation of the global pandemic and the emergence of new variants of the coronavirus, along with the economic crisis being faced by most nations. Only a powerful movement for people's health and universal vaccines can beat back the offensive by Big Pharma, coupled with the ongoing vaccine apartheid by the rich countries. Well, dear listeners, that was a second and concluding part of Prabir Purkayastha's article, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. Till next time, take care and goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, fulfillment of promise by the Prophet. The Prophet fulfilled his promises at every cost. And these promises, mind you, were not only made to other believers and to his friends, these promises in some cases were with the enemies of Islam and the enemies of Prophet. One of the clearest examples of the Prophet keeping his word in social matters is the incident concerning Abu Basir. Abu Basir was one of the Muslims in the Battle of Mecca who fled to Medina after the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. The elders of the Quraysh wrote a letter to the Messenger of Allah and gave it to a particular individual who, along with his slave, was to take it to Medina in order to implement the law in regards to Abu Basir and bring him back to Medina. When the Prophet ﷺ received the letter, he requested Abu Basir to come and he said to him, "You know that we have made an oath with the Quraysh and it is not right for us to violate our oath. God will provide relief for you and others like you." So brothers and sisters, see how the Prophet of Allah, he is keeping his commitment. He is honoring that oath and that contract that he had with the kuffar. He tells Abu Basir that the law has to be implemented. While you are our companion, while we want to preserve you, while you're a good Muslim, but you would have to abide by the law and we have to stick to our commitment. Now, what happened with Abu Basir, we're going to explain to you after the break. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing fulfillment of promises by Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And we said that the Prophet fulfilled his promises at every cost. Now, we're talking about an extreme situation here where the Prophet, he made a commitment and a treaty with the Kuffar, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, right? With the Kuffar, and we are in a situation where Abu Basir was told to abide by the law. So, what did Abu Basir say in response to the Messenger of Allah? He said, "O the Messenger of Allah, are you going to return me to the enemies who will cause me to forsake my religion?" So he raised this question and asked a question to Rasulullah. Now, look what the Prophet said. The Prophet said, "Go back, Abu Basir. God will provide relief for you and others like you." Right? Look, again, it's a very difficult and sensitive situation. The Kuffar and Mushrikeen, they could have just, you know, killed him. They could have just chopped off their head as they used to do to the companions of Prophet. But Prophet is fulfilling his promise. He's fulfilling his commitment. He's fulfilling that treaty. Now, Abu Basir, right, with this response from Prophet, he headed back with the two that were sent to take him, right? The story continues, right? And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala releases Abu Basir. This is, you know, amazing. Again, we don't have time to go into the entire story. It's in the books of history. But remember and know how Prophet is setting example for all of his followers, for all of the Muslims. Right? It's a difficult decision to be made. But those difficult decisions sometimes are to be made. So remember, fulfill your promise just like the Prophet fulfilled his. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.